book here somewhere. Bud will know immediately.
The Human Paradox?
That's the paper section in there somewhere.
The mixture of our natures.
Yeah.
Well, the Human Paradox is tied right into Adjusters. When you stop and think that you superimpose on a real mammalian critter a spark of infinity, I don't think anyone this side of God would have the courage to do that. The indwelling of the Adjuster, to me, testifies to God's originality and to God's amazing courage. Stop and think. We are the farthest out. We are the lowest on the totem pole. There is nothing below us which can know God. And yet he's given us a part of himself, something which I would expect him to do to folks that were way up the topside. And yet he doesn't indwell them. He doesn't even indwell our near of kin unless they've done time, so to speak. The atoms usually have to serve on a world. The secondary midwares wait a long time to get this. And yet, it's our birthright. Isn't that amazing? We who are the very lowest should have the closest spiritual relationship to God, something which even a Lanonandek son does not have. He's not indwelt by the Universal Father. Solitary messenger, speaking of Adjuster, says, no one, I know no one, but wouldn't delight to be host to a thought adjuster. This thing is hard to understand. It's hard for me to understand how Jesus got here. But the author of the paper dealing with the world of the Father says, the evolution of the immortal soul, its fusion with the Adjuster, and the making of these two antipodal creatures, one being, is a great mystery to us. Now, he said, obviously it's not a mystery to you, because all ascending is open to you. But there's a sector of ascending that's forever closed to me. And he said, furthermore, it's interesting to observe that you never tell us how this happened. He said, I don't know whether you cannot. I only know that you do not. This thought adjuster, like personality, has got the potential for all future time in it. This is a gas tank that's, to all practical intents and purposes, spiritually bottomless. This thought adjuster is a fragment of the first source and center on pre-personal levels. This thought adjuster is a fragment out here. I think I would say that it's awful presumptuous to spot it one place or another. But I know it's not here, because here God's functioning personally, and I think he is here too. He's Father of the Son at this concept point. I think maybe here would be super personal. Pretty personal, personal, super personal.
Would you, Bill, go over that once for Dorothy to see what those circles are about?
Can you see him, Dorothy?
Yeah.
Can you see him?
Yes.
Well, we started out here with our fried egg.
Yeah.
And then we pulled the yolk out, mm-hmm. leaving the white. And then we put a circle joining the two, symbolizing the appearance of the universal absolute.
Oh, well then the first fried egg is who? I thought those were the absolute.
No, no. This is before, this is where we're going back as far as we can go.
Yeah.
This is way back when. Before anything has happened.
Before the zero.
Yeah, that's right. And I use these three light circles to symbolize the three absolutes, because they're not the same, and yet they're linked.
Now, why is the one the absolute?
Here?
No, first or the...
I've kept the white of the egg identified all the way through.
Yes, okay, yeah.
As the unqualified.
Then, here I've still got my three-way linkage, only now the Father has separated himself from the Son. And at the same time has ejected paradise. Paradise has deity as its source, but paradise is outside of deity. It's undeified. It's non-deity. And then here, I've taken the Father-Son relationship, derived the third source and center, who activates paradise and causes paradise to do two things. Crystallize Havona and deliver space potency, or the stuff of the uncreated future universes, into the custody of the white of the egg, the unqualified absolute.
That's wonderful. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Now, we were, in talking about adjusters, we've got this pre-personal function of the Father, or of God, or of deity. How can you say pre-personal and then use the word Father in the same sentence? I would speculate that this is the level at which adjusters are fragmented. Because remember, all of these are present. When this happened, this did not stop. This went right on. All of these things happened, and yet the thing, the preceding thing, continued in existence. This, of course, we can, but we're not talking about us, we're talking about God. God is still pre-personal. God is also personal. And the best super-personal function I can think of God is the Trinity. It's not a person. It's beyond personality. But it doesn't mean he stopped being a person simply because he's pre and post. God exists before personality, as personality, and after personality.
Dave Schlund, who is a minister in the group there at Chicago, said that he had been so floundering around in his religious thinking before he found the Urantia book. And that he was helped so much by the statement in the Urantia book that about the personality of God, that God cannot be less than a person. God is much, much more than a person, but he can't be less. And it's that much more that took in Paul Tillich, that he had been reading so much, and other people, that had made him flounder.
Well, the three aspects of God as a sub-absolute being, one is personality, and the other two are related to personality, before and after. They never speak of the adjuster as non-personal or sub-personal. Tiglath is sub-personal. The adjuster is pre-personal. The adjuster, while not a person, has full capacity to achieve personality, to receive personality, either through fusion or in his own name and right. And if I've got to use a pronoun, I've got to use the word he for a thought adjuster. I can't use the word it. But technically, maybe it is better than he, but it violates my feelings.
Can you say them?
Mm-hmm. Them is the best.
Bill.
Yes.
Some time ago, there was a proposal that we needed a descriptive word, Don.
A what?
As Don. Yes. It's impersonal.
Uh-huh.
I had a cousin, and he would speak to his wife. He says, now, the man should be absolutely impersonal in his relation to his wife. So he called his wife Don. That was proposed as a new word.
What a horrible application.
How do you spell that word?
T-H-O-N. It's the corruption of thee. I would be inclined to derive adjusters at this level, because the adjuster seems to operate in relation to paradise circuits just as well as to the circuits of the eternal Son. When the adjuster travels, he travels on a circuit. We think of the adjuster as a spiritual entity. But the adjuster doesn't choose to travel on the spirit gravity circuits of the eternal sun. The adjuster elects to travel on the material circuits of the Isle of Paradise, because the adjuster stems from a level which is antecedent to both the sun and paradise. He's just as much at home operating over the paradise circuits as he is over spiritual circuits. The adjuster is a part of the incomprehensibleness of the first source and center of this level.
Can he travel on spiritual circuits?
I assume he could. I assume for some reason the paradise circuits are more convenient to him. And that's why I derive him from this level. A level which is conceptually antecedent to the sun and to paradise.
Putting him there, he was in contact with God without paradise. And isn't there a species of gravity that God retained?
No.
And gave to nobody?
No. He centered it in paradise.
Well, he controls physical gravity.
Through paradise.
Are we talking about physical gravity?
The only gravity which God delegated to no one is personality gravity. He centered physical gravity in the Isle of Paradise. He centered spiritual gravity in the eternal sun. Mind gravity is inherent in the infinite spirit. But personality gravity, or the personality circuit, centers in the universal father.
Gravity.
No, I don't think anybody travels on personality gravity. You see, there are four realities: matter, mind, spirit, and personality. And personality differs from the other three in that the three have quantity as well as quality, but personality has quality only. And that's why personality, the most potent of the three, is so dependent. If you want to think of personality, let's think of the abstract color yellow. Don't think of a yellow anything, just think of yellow. Can you feel that abstraction in your mind? All right, that's what we're talking about when we're talking about personality as such, alone, isolated. It can't register because you cannot have yellow. You can only have a yellow something. Am I right? You cannot have personality alone. You can only have personality if it's got a life vehicle to color. And given a life vehicle, it dominates that life vehicle. It determines the color of that vehicle. In paper 12 on the universe of universes, they can compute gravity action. Quantitatively. And that's where they work out this wonderful computation that 95% of paradise gravity is occupied with materializations in the outer space level. That 85% of the gravity, no, I got it wrong. Let me check this. Yes, 15% of the gravity, I haven't figured it first, 15% of mind gravity is working out there.
And what about the physical?
95%. That's about right, you know. You get the setup men out there. They're running the bulldozers. Apparently no spiritual gravity, but they hedge. They said if a few spiritual beings were out there, we couldn't detect it because the numbers are so enormous. So that if there are any spiritual beings out there, there are so few that we can't find them in our calculations. I think there are a few out there. Solitary messengers could go out there. They could travel the mind gravity circuit. But they make this statement. Personality gravity is non-computable. We recognize the circuit, but we cannot measure either qualitative or quantitative realities responsive thereto. So to me, personality, as I find it convenient to think about it, is quality, pure quality, non-quantity. And I think of a color all by itself, It's like thinking of personality all by itself. In actuality, you can't have it. You've got to have a something which is that color. And something has to have that personality.
What happens to personality when we die?
No one knows. They tell us what happens to everything else. When they disassemble, when death disassembles a human being, the body oxidizes eventually. The mind ceases to be an individuation. I symbolize that in my mind by saying the seven adjutants which are working in each of our cortices, what is the plural cortex? Think of a rope which has a loop in it. That loop symbolizes a human mind. And when that person dies, I think they pull the rope out straight. There's no loop anymore. In other words, the circuit is there, but my individualized portion of the circuit is gone when I die. My soul, the guardian seraphim, group or person, takes that into custody. The adjuster goes back into Vinnington and stands by. The personality, the archangels have taken the fingerprints of personality. They can identify it again, but they have no custody of it, merely a record. They can be sure it's the same person. Now, let's kill Bud off. He won't mind.
I'm about ready.
He's had a full life.
He's had a full life. And when they get ready to reassemble Bud, the seraphim arrives up on the resurrection hall in the first mansion world. The proper technicians go over to the quartermaster department and say, we would like one GI body, general issue body, suitable for sodium chloride, for an ex-sodium chloride life pattern emerging from a sphere having these coordinates. And they get on and give him the physical type of Urantia. He's a mid-breather. He operated at such and such a thermal level. The electrical potential of the planet was such and such. In other words, they're going to give him a body that he'll feel at home in, see? A suit that fits. I think these differences diminish as you go up the mansion worlds. But on the first mansion worlds, it's at home. It's very important that you get something you'll feel right in. So they take this GI body and they lay it down on a slab, I think of a marble slab. This thing looks like a morgue to me because I'm reasoning by analogy. That's where we left here and that's where we take off up there. This seraphim plunks Bud's soul in the appropriate upper end of this forked body. I think it'll look very human. He's got legs, hands, and whatnot. If they wake me up too different, it'll frighten me, you know. We've got to be gentle. We're nervous.
How big is Bud at this point?
I think it's the right size for Bud. Normal size. He's an adult.
No, he's not 6 pounds, 3 ounces.
No. He's about 120 pounds or so. Yes.
Wasn't it Jesus' Marantia body that the people saw when he came?
Yes, but they fixed it so they could see him. And he didn't look unhuman.
Well, would that be the same?
Yes, exactly the same. Yes, exactly the same. So the seraphim plunks Bud's soul down in his brain, as I think of it, like some kind of a Marantia cortex. This is almost a physical body. You could break a leg. It is just technically not physical.
It helps me to call it physical, but not material.
Non-combustible is a good word.
It's all but physical.
It doesn't need.
It's 99.9%, 9/10% physical. Now, they get a Marantia mind circuit. They get an electrician in there with this mind circuit. And they run a loop in there, see? The thought adjuster is returned, takes up his position in the citadel of the mind. And then personality reaches out and seizes this mind circuit. And that's the return of consciousness. And they go over and they take the fingerprint of the personality, and the archangels can testify this is the same guy Kagan who made it, God knows how. We're all surprised, we didn't expect it. It shows the Father's love, it passes all understanding. So they put up a brass monument there and they say, erected to the memory of Bud Kagan who made it, and this is a new revelation of the infinity of God's love, because well, the odds were bad against it too. Now, where personality is during this span, no one knows. No one knows.
Why couldn't his body be electrical? Very nearly electrical.
It is.
It is.
Basically, the nervous system.
Is
the real.
Pardon, I beg your pardon.
The real humanity of all of us is electrical.
Well, so I mean the new system. I mean the one who will be resurrected.
Would be too shocking. Be too shocking to us. We're used to something corporeal. If we woke up. If we woke up with the physical body of a secondary midwayer, it would be a profound shock. It'd be a traumatic experience. A midwayer is a living electrical pattern. A secondary midwayer, a completely physical being. A midwayer here. Let's analyze out what is the true human part of man. It's his nervous system. Now, have you ever seen a picture of a human nervous system?
Yeah.
All right. Visualize that apart from the corporeal body. Somehow endow it with the ability to hang together without the body. Now you're trying to visualize the physical body of a secondary midwayer. He's an electrical pattern. You see, a secondary midwayer is a human being minus all mammalian factors, best symbolized by the fact that he has none of the mammalian adjutants, but the top two adjutants, worship and wisdom, function in the mind of a secondary midwayer. If you could subtract Tiglath from us, we would be midwayers. You follow me? Now, if we woke up that way, Ruth, It would be a horrible shock. Imagine going in front of a mirror and seeing a nervous system. You want to see...
You are contending that we are a lot more physical than that.
Oh, heavens, I think we're virtually corporeal. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, how could we have an accident?
I know.
In the lower Marantia levels...
Water.
Yes, in the lower Marantia levels...
Water.
We can have a physical accident. Only it's not too rough. You get another general issue body up the line. You leave these bodies behind, you know, seven times.
Now, what happens to Mr. Kagan's accumulated experiences?
All right.
His traumatic experiences and.
Bud Kagan's soul. There are two. There are two living factors. There are three factors that persist. The soul, the adjuster, and personality. The soul, from a functional standpoint, has two kinds of memory. As far as the soul is concerned, it's one kind. All these tapes, which Bud has been cutting, and which are registered electrically, probably, in the cortex, have been retaped on the soul level. Not all of them. All the significant ones have. And some of those have been retaped on the adjuster level. So you have progressive screening. Example. Bud might have an experience which is morally significant, but not spiritually significant. I'm sure that the soul would tape an experience of moral significance because it's super animal, but we're told that morality is sub-spiritual, so I don't think the adjuster would tape it. You get the difference?
Yes.
I don't think the soul would tape the spinal reflex memories involved in tying a bow knot in shoelaces. You follow me? I'm trying to get a feeling for selectivity.
Yes.
Now, this means that when Bud wakes up up there, to the extent that the adjuster has taped things, that immediately activates the corresponding tapes on the level of the soul. So the Marantia consciousness is in immediate possession of that fraction of memory. Some memory is completely gone. I think it would be a damn nuisance to retain it. Tying shoelaces symbolizes that. Or remembering, oh, I have a pretty good memory about the movement of transportation all over the United States. I know about what line I'm going to take. I can see no value to that on the first mansion work. It's handy to me here now. I can say I want to fly on such and such a line, or I want to catch such and such a train. I've been there. Of course, with the trains now, they're all gone. I remember so many trains that don't exist anymore. Now, this leaves the inactive tapes at the soul level. They can be activated. There are two ways in which I think they are activated. Number one, Bud bumps into Ruth Burton up there, and they're reminiscing. They had a common experience, which was of moral and ethical significance to Bud, but of spiritual significance to Ruth, for whatever reason. And as they get into this point of reminiscence, Ruth starts talking about this episode, and Bud says, wait a minute, I'll say that again. And as she repeats that episode, it activates this tape. And a feeling of reality, an emotional fact is attached to it. As Bud hears this tape activated in his own memory, and from then on, it's an active tape. Ruth resurrected it. I think there's one other way. Well, your seraphim can tell you a lot of stories too, you know. There's another way in which this happens. And this is the most mysterious of all. Personality, I think, can in some way, in some degree, activate these dormant tapes. Bud is walking down some Marantia promenade, and all of a sudden he'll stop and you will turn around. I think this is a common miracle, you know? In other words, it's an ordinary thing. But nobody can explain it. When you can't explain something, it's miraculous. Like human conception, a common miracle. Divine incarnation, an uncommon miracle. All of a sudden, he'll stop and he'll turn around. He didn't know you'd gotten there. He hasn't been down and checking over new arrivals, see? And in each of your memories will be activated a remembrance of who in the dickens you are in relation to each other. You were friends down here and knew about the blue book together.
Personal relationships are supposed to be eternal. Of eternal value.
We're told that we will remember. We're told that the relationships between personalities is always an end, never a means. It has final value. Now, little by little, I think, in the course of 100 years, 1,000 years, 10,000 years, I think all of the significant dormant tapes we have will be reactivated.
All the soul ones that have
survived
in the soul.
Go ahead.
Yeah, go ahead.
No.
Then you haven't quite explained to me, at least not to my satisfaction, what happens to these experiences that Bud has accumulated here when he dies.
They constitute character. Even that which is dormant in terms of concrete memory still functions in terms of character. And I would describe character as the pattern of the soul, containing all of the beauty and all of the ugliness which characterizes the souls of each of us at the moment of death. All of the good work we've done and all of the unfinished business goes right on over there. Our weaknesses persist. And you remember they inventory them? equivocation, procrastination, unfairness, ease-seeking, problem avoidance. Our actions will be unethical and submoral to the extent that these deficiencies persist. Our actions will be ethical and moral and excellent to the extent that we have developed sound character down here. The early decisions of the Marantia soul, or the personality working at the level of the soul, are largely determined by the character momentum persisting from this life into the next life. You almost might borrow a Buddhist term. You might say our karma persists. Causality, continuity. But the Buddhists are awfully close to a lot of truth there. I don't like their end objective, which is nothingness. But the notion that your unfinished business goes on is quite sound. The papers validate that. Only they don't validate a circularity of reincarnation. It's a linear thing leading from here to paradise.
Then Bud will not come back, be transported, say, through a thought adjuster to someone else?
No. Bud will be himself. Bud will be himself, and you know the Buddhist concept of karma is good here. Bud's actions will be, he will begin working out his karma on the first mansion world. I've never used that word in this connection before, but it's a good one. Yes, there is no Christian theological word that expresses it. Because in the Christian concept, you're purged or you burn. The Buddhist concept is much better. You pick up your package where you left it and start on the same journey.
How do you explain geniuses here, say Mozart and so on?
Geniuses are explained, I think, first of all, by the genes. The gene pattern produced a cortex, a physical cortex, which would take more loop of mind in some area. Then I think upon De Vinnington, when the thought adjusters volunteer. If an adjuster had indwelt some mortal somewhere and had experience which would be valuable to this genius, I think that adjuster would be given the assignment. Let's say that at the time of the 12 apostles, a thought adjuster on De Vinnington who had indwelled a great orator should have volunteered for the Alpheus twins. I think they wouldn't let him serve. All that experience would be wasted. They'd assign him to Peter. But of course, I think the adjuster would have volunteered for Peter. The Alpheus twins got adjusters, but I don't think they would waste experience on the Alpheus twins, since all adjusters are identical in quality of divinity. Then, plus starting out with basic human aptitude, the adjuster may contribute something, and the celestial artisans may further contribute something. They work with these folks. In other words, if you've got a lot, they give you a lot more, but they don't waste. The adjuster of a great writer, why waste him on a ditch digger? Let's give him to Milton.
Yeah, back to that personality question. I've thought about that again. The personality is a gift of God, so is the thought adjuster. Now the personality is the distinguishing characteristic, the unique feature of it, that uses the mind. The body, the mind isn't the personality. The body isn't the personality. It's the X factor that uses the mind.
It's the unpredictable factor.
Yeah. And inasmuch as the personality is a gift to God, and the thought adjuster chose, volunteered, for activity in this particular personality. There must have been a blueprint of this personality and individual for that adjuster to to consider volunteering to do that job. So I was that they're closely allied in the survival after death, because it both from God, it both draws back to God.
But personality is that which gives you identity, I think. And it says in the papers on personality, personality can make a gift to God, the dedication of doing the Father's will. So therefore, he gives you something to work with and hopes you will come back with it as a unified, integrated identity with all these other factors. But I don't particularly think that there's anything other than the element of chance involved there.
We could choose not to go along. But in this survival after death business, it seemed to me that the thought gesture would be the one who could identify the personality, or there's a close alliance there. Their fiancés, their prospect.
But there's one more thing that's just as potent, and that's free will choice.
That's the function of personality.
The free will choice can upset the apple cart.
And without it, it won't do anything. You've got to make a choice to do one thing or the other. You just can't say, I'm gonna pass this hand and see how the game goes. Because I think you're going to...
You're out then.
You're out. It's either up or down.
And we were talking about this matter of identification after in the dimension.
Yeah.
Where does the personality go at death?
In the reassembly.
In the reassembly.
They don't know.
That's what I'm talking about. My speculation is that the personality must be closely aligned with the covenant of God, because the personality comes from God. They're.
You think maybe it's gone back to Divinington?
The personality never came from Divinington.
From God himself.
He's just speculating that it's hanging around there.
No,
aren't you?
That the reassembly, that the thought adjuster must have something to do with the identification of it. Because they've got to go on together, the personality and the thought adjuster.
But the archangel identified it.
Yeah. In the sense that he's got a fingerprint.
Or he. Archangel.
Figure it.
Archangels must be he, but other angels she.
Well,
archangel is a son of God.
These adjusters volunteer, and they do so with pretty good foreknowledge, because they assemble a blueprint of the projection of the human being.
Who does? Isn't that a projection of the possibilities?
No, let's read what it says.
Yeah, but somebody's watching the genes.
Although we do not definitely know, we firmly believe that all thought adjusters are volunteers. But before ever they volunteer, they are in possession of full data respecting the candidate for indwelling. The seraphic drafts of ancestry and projected patterns of life conduct are transmitted via paradise to the reserve corps of adjusters on Divinington, by the reflectivity technique extending inward from the capitals of the local universe to the headquarters of the superuniverse. This forecast covers not only the hereditary antecedents of the mortal candidate, but also the estimate of probable intellectual endowment and spiritual capacity. The adjusters thus volunteer to indwell minds of whose intimate natures they have been fully appraised.
Bill, a good one for that is, look at this jet you came out on the other mm-hmm. day. 15 years ago, they designed that jet and never flew it, and they were building equipment on the ground to handle it on its projected specification. The thing never flew. It worked out within 1% of what they said it would. Well, this is a mechanical thing, but in a sense, it's a projection.
Sure.
And they geared the whole thing to it. It worked. It could have not worked, because this has happened also, but most times it does.
They know what they're doing. Maybe more than one volunteers. Maybe they have to be chosen. But the comforting thing to me is that no thought adjusters are ever drafted. Everyone is a volunteer, and he knows what he's getting into.
Maybe
must have an awful lot of courage.
They're part of God. They have the courage of the universal Father, who is the source of courage as well as of love, I think.
The patience.
Sure. Well, now, wait a minute, Ruth. You can't say an adjuster has patience.
Because they're not time conscious.
They're not time conscious.
It just seems to me they must have patience. But when they look,
you remember it says, do you remember it says that patience is exercised only by humans whose time units are short? You remember that?
I think I do. It sounds familiar.
It's over here in the back of the book in their discussion of time and space.
Whose time was it short?
I'll read it to you.
Bill, on these two tapes you mentioned, which I like the analogy for the memory transcript of the soul and that of the adjuster, wouldn't you say that you could almost correlate that with that which took place utilizing the last two adjutants of mortal mind, one for one and one for the other?
Mm-hmm.
Oh.
Could be.
Moral and...
I don't think the soul tapes too much on the lower adjutant level, bottom five. That's mammalian thinking. And a whole heck of a lot of our thinking takes place on that level. Mm-hmm. I'm pretty sure the top two adjutants register. And of course there must be many confusional episodes that are in emulsion. And what do you do with this one, see?
Spiritual motive with a moral repercussion.
Yeah. Or let's say a moral motive with a gregarious repercussion. It says here, patience is exercised by those mortals whose time units are short. True maturity transcends patience by a forbearance born of real understanding.
What page is that?
That's on 1295. They're discussing time and eternity. And that's true too, you know. If you understand how things are going to work out pretty well, you're not patient, you're understanding. If you don't understand, then you've got to be patient. And if you haven't got that much wisdom, you're impatient.
You're frustrated.
You're frustrated, yes. A patient person is sublimating frustration.
No, I like that.
If he can't do that, he becomes a patient, but a different kind.
Let's take inventory of personality. We've let's look over to 1225. I think the best definition of personality that's given in these papers is permanence in the presence of change. That appears in the last two lines of the first paragraph. And how can our personalities be unchanging when we change so? Well, let's look at it this way. Let's compare a human being to a necklace of beads. The beads are changing. Character changes. We grow, I hope, in knowledge and perhaps in wisdom. Certainly we profit by our errors. Our judgment improves. Our attitudes change. Personality survival, Bob.
1225.
The beads are continually changing. But personality is the strand on which are strung these beads of worship and wisdom and character and memory and love and emotion and other things not so nice. If the strand changed, it wouldn't be us. There are two things that are never going to change about us if we fuse with our thought adjusters. One is the quality of divinity in the thought adjuster. And the other is our personality. The adjuster will change experientially as he experiences. Our soul will grow the relationship between the surviving self, the soul, and the adjuster is an ever-changing thing. It's nothing but change. And if it stopped changing, this would be death. But the personality is changeless, only expanding into new levels of function. But it's the same personality.
That is not what psychologists
mean. No.
They use the word.
We often use the word personality as synonymous with sex appeal, or with friendliness, or extroversion. This is a different. They're doing the personality what they've done to space. They've attached new meaning to it.
How we affect other people.
Yes. Yeah. Yes.
The social impact, that is the sense.
And of course, that's not untruthful.
No, it's just not all.
Because the personality does shine through us.
What's lacking in the psychologists?
They have no basis for such a concept.
They have no idea.
Well, I just want you to say what it is, though, that's lacking.
In
the Urantian psychologist's use of the word personality.
They have no conception of survival or of the source of free will. They're looking at man from the outside, and these papers are describing man from the inside.
Well, isn't it this thing that I always relate to you with, the spirit nucleus of the individual?
They don't believe in that.
I know they don't, but that's where they're missing the boat.
A psychologist would talk a lot about the subconscious, and these papers recognize the working value of such a concept, but they also say this is superconscious.
Bill, on page 1223, there are a bunch of whys. I wonder if you could answer me satisfactorily, please. It's
1223.
It's the third paragraph of the adjuster's problem.
Mm-hmm. Yes. I'll tell you why we don't do this. We're animals. We're lazy. We're inert. The papers point out that primitive man only thought when he was hungry. We require the stimulus of pain. No, we do most of our thinking when we're hurt. Hunger isn't such a problem anymore, but primitive man went into action when he got hungry, his tummy hurt, he was uncomfortable. The same principle applies to so-called civilized man, or better still, man in process of civilization, which is what we are. When all goes well, we tend to become fat, dumb, and happy. Best symbolized. Consider a Cro-Magnon, beautiful specimen, intelligent, artistic, the guy paints on cave walls. It's been a rough hunting season. This guy is really down to red meat. He hasn't eaten for several days, and he's got a family. And he's picked up a spore. Watch that guy. Every movement is poetry. He's totally mobilized. Every iota of his high intelligence is concentrated on the kill. Look at him perched on the branch of a tree. God, you could carve a statue of this character. Every muscle is etched there. His timing, you can see that keen intelligence figuring the motion of the animal, the arc of the spear. He draws back ever so silently. Wham! And it's a kill.
He could hypnotize me.
And now I want you to look at him 2 hours later. He's got blood on his mouth. His gut is distended. He's gorged himself. He's lying there, asleep under the tree. The flies are buzzing around his dirty face. Which would you pick to paint?
I liked him in that poise.
Of course.
Ready for the
attack. Of course. Why was he so mobilized? He had a problem. He hurt. And now, do you perceive why they say in these papers that civilization is being forged out between the anvils of anguish and the hammers of suffering? Because this is the only time we get up off of our dead backsides and do something. We have to hurt. It takes this kind of a stimulus to cope with animals like us. And it takes this whiplash to cope with us until we catch fire. There are better stimuli, but until we respond to them, they ask these questions. Why don't you do something about this?
Why? Intellectually we know this, but emotionally we don't seem to be able to generate any...
I agree with you.
I think he takes a terrific
urge
and push to make people really mobilize all their power to one end.
I'll tell you when it happens.
Enhanced ability, so much of the time, just casually do things. And I don't think we just devote our whole energy very often. And he says something, you've got to devote your whole energy to spiritual growth.
I think the biggest thing here is most people want to get this adjuster talking to them before they ever start doing anything about it, and they say, why do you not aid the adjuster? I think you got to do a lot of aiding before you ever...
A listening.
Well, yes, here we go. You know. We are on the fifth mansion world now. Imagine. On the fifth mansion world, a real birth of cosmic consciousness takes place on Mansonia number 5. You are becoming universe-minded. This is indeed a time of expanding horizons. It is beginning to dawn upon the enlarging minds of the ascending mortals that some stupendous and magnificent, some supernal and divine destiny awaits all who complete the progressive paradise ascension, which has been so laboriously but so joyfully and auspiciously begun. At about this point, the average mortal ascender begins to manifest bona fide experiential enthusiasm for the Avona ascent. Study is becoming voluntary, unselfish service natural, and worship spontaneous. A real Marantxa character is budding. A real Marantxa creature is evolving. On about the fifth mansion world, we begin to respond to positive lures instead of negative drives. And again,
realize what the gift of God is in being a son.
They're talking about our fraternization with the Marantxa, with the transition ministers, the seraphim up there. And they're talking about the ones that are not on assignment. These are seraphim that are unassigned, they're in reserve. Next to the guest destiny guardians, these transition ministers draw the nearest to human beings of all orders of seraphim, and many of your leisure moments will be spent with them. Angels take delight in service when unassigned, often ministers, volunteers. The soul of many an ascending mortal has for the first time been kindled by the divine fire of the will to service through personal friendship with the volunteer servers of the seraphic reserves. You like your buddy, and it rubs off on you. Now, this is my feeling about these whys. We seem to alternate between Cro-Magnon, mobilized for the kill, and Cro-Magnon with his gut full. And while we all crave the full gut, the poetry is not there. The artistry is not there. The beauty is not there. And that's just as true of civilized man as it was of our more primitive ancestors, because we aren't civilized.
Wouldn't you also,
if we were civilized, they wouldn't ask these questions.
Wouldn't you also add, Bill, that the Cro-Magnon wasn't a very sociable individual anyway, and since we're all Cro-Magnons in a sense?
Yes.
We don't have too good a heritage.
I don't know why this statement is true, but it is. It's certainly true in my experience. I spent so much of my life being a slob, and so little of my life being civilized. I'm a great disappointment to myself, as I'm sure you are to yourself. Sure. I think we all are terribly disappointed in ourselves. And that's why the psychological technique of rationalization is so vital. It helps us live with ourselves without actually hating ourselves.
Yeah.
Some rationalization, I think, is indispensable as crutches to this particular level of being a tadpole, as long as there isn't too much of it.
Here's a childish question, if you ever heard one. I read this book. I want to read it thoroughly. I want to read it all. But I want to live it. I don't want just the words to come in and know it intellectually. I want to live it. How? How do you start? Now, that's very childish, but it's...
It's a very good question. I can't speak for anyone but myself. This is too intimate. What in essence you've asked me is, what is your religion, not your theology or philosophy? I'm interested in getting as much help from my partner as I can. I feel rather diffident about discussing my problems with an infinite God, even though in my mind and heart I know he's got all the time in the world for me. But somehow it seems presumptuous. He's running a big universe. And it seems to me that there are so many other things that he could more profitably spend his time on. But I don't feel that way about this thought adjuster, because this thought adjuster is God individuated for me. And I am his business. For this particular assignment, I am his principal concern. He may have some peripheral activities going on, but they're definitely secondary to me. Just as you are primary to the function of your thought adjuster. I have no hesitancy about discussing anything with this thought adjuster. I have a feeling of comradeship for him. And let me explain, I've never heard him say anything to me. If I ever did, it should probably scare me quite out of my wits, and I would immediately feel this is paranoia, you know. And I would put the whole thing on ice and think about it for quite a number of weeks and months until my human judgment could evaluate it, or until a little time passed. And yet I have never doubted that this is a dialogue. It's a dialogue between two conscious beings, one of whom is deaf. I can talk, but I can't hear. And I don't let my deafness impair my faith in the least. I keep asking my partner for help in certain directions. How can I be more useful? How can we do a better job about coping with my ego, this belligerent self that I'm not sure I've conquered at all? And if I were sure, then I'd be afraid of that concept too. I'd fear this was spiritual pride, you know, which goeth before a hell of a crash. I try to tell my partner about what life is like down here. There's a whole lot that he doesn't get out of this world, because he doesn't have eyes, you know, doesn't have ears. He has a sensory mechanism, but it's quite different from mine. I know he's trying to tell me about paradise, so I tell him about this world, what it means to me. When we go to a new city, I try to let him see the city through my eyes. We talk about this. I probably spend more time talking to him in the privy than any other single place on earth, because there's the one place I'm sure to be alone. That's why I occasionally ride trains in a bedroom. One is alone. But that's not just because I love my thought adjuster. I happen to be a creature who needs periodic solitude. This is temperamental. I think if I'm going to be able to live more of this, he's got to help me. He's got to help me be less of a mammal and more human. The heck with being more spiritual. This is for the future. I'm content if I can just become less mammalian and more human. I'm not trying to be a frog. I can think about frogdom, but I'm a tadpole now. I'm not trying to get out on dry land. I wouldn't live. I've got to live in the water. I'll wake up on dry land. I ask my partner, how can I be of more service? Because in my religion, there's none of this. My religion is very, very simple. Somewhere at the center of all things is the boss. And these odd critters I bump into down here on Earth are the boss's kids. And they should be treated accordingly. That's my religion. I can say it in three sentences. And my partner's interested in this. Because he comes from the boss. He understands that these are the boss's kids. And I'm sure he'll help me in every way he can. I have no doubts about this. Now the thing that dismays me is my own inconstancy. This mammalian inertia. Not that I do evil or sinful things, but I don't do enough. It's not that I dwell on sinful thoughts, but that I forget to deal with the boss and my partner. And yet, the book tells me that God can look on the inside of me and see that dismaying and dismal picture, which I know about, and he still loves me. And I consider the imperfections of the 12 apostles. And believe me, if you want to deal with their negatives, and I made a speech on that subject last night, they're all a bunch of slobs. But they also had qualities, and Jesus loved them. And most of them played way over their heads. Just think, let's take inventory of the 12. Andrew, inexpressive, had a hard time complimenting people. Peter, mercurial, undependable. John, big ego, shone through in the fourth gospel too, when he was old, senile. He was the apostle whom Jesus loved. James, no discretion, got himself killed off early in the game because he just didn't realize what wasn't his business. Philip, no imagination. Nathaniel, a wisecracker. Matthew, guy with a kind of a lurid past. A publican, a tax squeezer. Simon Zelotes, a pig-headed patriot. Thomas, bad disposition. Wife delighted when he joined up so he'd be away from home. Judas, a well-educated prig. The Alpheus twins, stupid. Now, when I think about this, I get encouraged. Here were some real card-carrying members of the human race in good standing that the Creator Son wasn't afraid to go into business with and to count not on these human mammalian weaknesses and limitations, but on what could be accomplished when his Father's Spirit worked within these men and when he worked with them as a man among men. And you know he had a pretty good batting average. He only struck out once. That's my religion. And to never quit trying. Make sense?
No, it's wonderful, lovely.
Now, you can say it pretty, but that isn't the way I talk.
I think that was beautiful.
Well, we've had a confession of faith. Should we have an altar call now? I find it, Betty, very difficult to talk about things like that. In fact, there are a whole bunch of people here I probably wouldn't have. Because this to me is awfully private. This is why I can be a teacher. I will never be worth a damn as a minister. I can't wear my spiritual heart on my sleeve. I've listened to Salyer preach, and it ain't in me. He's a good preacher. Terrific. I can't exhort. Let's go back to personality. I think this is fun, incidentally. It's a dismaying fun. And the humor which I bring to bear on my own religious problems is rueful humor. It's a hopeless stern chase, you see. My ideals of what a man should be are growing geometrically. But at best, my progress is a limping arithmetic progression. And I'm in the sad fix of a guy who, in a rowboat, is diligently chasing a motorboat. Now, when I was about 15 or 17, I was running neck and neck with that motorboat. I was pretty hot stuff. When you're a young Marine, you've got it made. You've arrived. Ever since then, the gap has been widening between the rowboat and the motorboat. And I've considered, this is a real paradox, I've considered the alternate reactions. One is to torpedo the motorboat. This eases all tension at the cost of all progress, or at least at the cost of all ideals. Then I thought of stopping rowing. You know, you say, oh, the hell with it. You know, they said it was impossible, and so we said the hell with it. And I think the best course of action is a third course, which is to draw deeply on humor. I can look at the riverbank, and I believe I'm making progress upstream. And then I look at the motorboat, and the damn thing's farther away from me than it ever was. I think at this point one should laugh. There are only two other alternatives, to cuss and to cry. And I think laughing is by far the best of the three.
And I'm on the bank still trying to hew out a log. I haven't gotten in the water yet.
Well, it's a stern chase, and you never make it. Here again with ideals, Betty. Ideals are like stars. If you're going to navigate at night, I can think of nothing more useful than to have these stars. But a navigator would be a fool if he thought he could actually sail to them. The place for stars is in the skies, not in one's eyes.
Oh, that's funny.
Yeah. They have a function. But our disappointments are born out of a misconception of their function, at least in this life. An anarchist is a real idealist. And when he gets to Havona, he can be happy. Because it says in here, concerning the government of the central universe, there is none. When beings are perfect or perfected, you don't need government anymore. But you do need it in time and space. Let's take it, huh?
I just want to say that one of the things that helped me about this contact with the, I shouldn't say contact, but you were talking about talking with your adjuster, is the realization that takes place in the super consciousness, that the deafness simply means that it isn't necessarily not real.
Sure, it's real. I know it's real.
Not necessarily, no communion, but the fact that you're deaf. Means that it takes place in the stupor conscious. And you're no more conscious of that than you are of the subconscious.
That's right.
But it's real.
Would you ever be conscious? And you are guided by it. And it can influence your life.
That helped me a lot to realize there was a
super
conscious. And the thought
adjuster
can use it.
If the thought adjuster did make contact with you, would you be conscious of it?
Be scared to death.
I don't think you would. I think you would be doing things that would probably be surprising yourself, but you
wouldn't.
Would you like a picture of human mind, Betty?
Yes, I love it.
You ever been to the planetarium?
Yes.
Have all of you been to the planetarium? I want you to visualize a double planetarium. It's got another hemisphere as well as an upper hemisphere. And in the center, with a support, is a platform. And on that platform, there's a searchlight. And this searchlight has got a 360-degree swing around the planetarium, and it's got an arc a little ways up and a little ways down. It can illuminate, if we can use some geographical terms, it can illuminate what I would call the torrid zone in the planetarium. It can hit the whole belt of the equator, and a little ways up and a little ways down. When we go into the south temperate area, below the torrid zone, I think we've hit the true subconscious. I think the north temperate area is the superconscious. I think the spot of light which you throw on the hemisphere is your consciousness at any given moment, and you can swing it around, as you know you can. I can visualize a problem in Cleveland right now, which is this telegram I got. And I can think about that. I can see George Hayes. I can see the problem of the Cold War going on between the editor and the editor-in-chief, with the editor running mad and the editor-in-chief running scared to death, to the point where he'll lie. And I can conceive of the red herrings we've got to use to save the situation. Now I'm back here in California. You follow me? I swung the spotlight. And I could feel it. When you go to sleep at night, you turn the spotlight out. And there's just a gentle gray glow all over. I think above the torrid zone, I mean above the north temperate zone in the upper hemisphere, in the polar regions, is the embryonic soul. And I visualize the adjuster at the North Pole. This soul is a true embryo. It's carried in the womb of the mind. And it was conceived when the adjuster invaded this hemisphere. And this soul is a growing entity. Now, down here on the platform, oh, you could carry it on farther down into spinal reflexes at the South Pole, you know, vegetative nervous system. On this platform is a red button. That's the red button of decision. And all decision takes place in the conscious level of the mind. All conscious decision. I can't make decisions at the level of the soul or the superconsciousness because I can't get my searchlight up there. I only get it so high. You follow me? There is a continual down trickle from the upper areas of darkness into places where I can find it, you know? It is a continual upwelling from the lower levels of the subconscious to the level where I can find it with a searchlight. When we wake up in the morning with a heck of a good solution to a very puzzling problem, it's a question as to where it came from. Did it come from bottom side or top side? I don't regard bottom side as nefarious, although it's distinctly mammalian in its lower levels. Bottom side can do a terrific IBM job of running through the memory cards and giving you a darned ingenious solution to a purely temporal material problem. I think a lot of good comes out of the subconscious, as well as a lot of balderdash. I think the spirit of truth is working in the upper hemisphere. I think all spiritual influences are in the upper hemisphere. I would say that the five mammalian adjutants work in the southern hemisphere. The two human adjutants and midware adjutants, worship and wisdom, the Holy Spirit, the Spirit of Truth, and the adjuster work in the northern hemisphere. This is my working model of a concept of a human mind.